'Twas on the shores that browned our coast, from Deal to Ramsgate span, that I spied alone on a piece of stone an elderly naval man. His hair was long, and his beard was weedy, and weedy and long was he. Well, I heard that blighty on the shore reciting in a singular minor key. Oh, I am the cook, and the captain bold, and the mate of the Nancy Brig. I'm the bosun tight, I'm the midship mate, and the crew the captain's gig. Well, he shook his fists and he tore his hair till I really felt afraid. I couldn't help thinking the man had been drinking, and so I simply said, O elderly naval man, it's little I know of duties of men of the sea, but I'll eat my hand if I understand. However you can be, at once, the cook and the captain bold and the mate of the Nancy Brig, and the bosun tight and the midshipmite and the crew of the captain's gig. He gave a hitch in his trousers, which is a trick all seamen learn. And having got rid of a thumping quid, he spun his painful yarn. He said, 'Twas on the good ship Nancy Bell that we sailed to the Indian Sea. But there on a reef we came to grief, which has often occurred to me. Pretty soon most of the crew was drowned, there was 77 to a soul. But only 10 of the Nancy's men, said I to the muster roll. There was myself and the cook, and the captain bold, and the mate of the Nancy Brig, and the bosun tight, and the midshipmite, and the crew of the captain's gig. For a month we had neither victuals nor drink, till the hungry we did feel. So we drew a lot, and accordin' shot the captain for a meal. The next lot fell to the captain's mate, in a delicate dish he made. Our appetites with the midshipmite, we 7 survivors stayed. Well, next we murdered the bosun tight, and he much resembled a pig. So we victualled free, did the cook and me, on the crew of the captain's gig. Till only the cook and I were left, and the delicate question, which of us two goes to the kettle arose, and we argued it out as such. For I loved that cook as a brother I did, and that cook, he worshipped me. But we'd both be blowed if we'd either be stowed, and the other one's hold, you see. I'll be eat if you dines of me, says Tom. Yes, that, says I, you'd be. I'll be boiled if I die, my friend, quote I. Exactly so, quote he. Says he, dear James, to murder me is a foolish thing to do. For don't you see that you can't cook me? Well, I can and will cook you. So he boils the water and takes the salt and pepper in portions true, and some chopped shallot, which he never forgot, and some sage and parsley too. Come here, says he, with a proper pride, which his smiling features tell. 'Twill soothing be if I let you see how extremely nice you'll smell. So he stirs the water around and around, smiling at the boiling broth. When I ups with his heels and smothered his squeals in the scum of the foaming froth. Well, I eat that cook in a week or less, and as I be eating the last of his chops, why, I almost drops, for a vessel in sight I see. No, I never laugh, I never smile, I seldom lark or play, but I sit and croak in one single joke I have, which is to say, Oh, I am the cook and the captain bold, and the mate of the Nancy Brig. I'm the bosun tight, and the midship mite, and the crew of the captain's gig.
Hey there, you're listening to 101.5 FM on UMFM. I'm your Tuesday 1 p.m. host, Ryan Funk. Today we'll be discussing some of the early people who immigrated to Canada, the Voyageurs and the Mennonites. Every February, we celebrate Voyageur, Métis, and First Nations histories here in Winnipeg with the largest winter festival in Western Canada, Festival du Voyageur. Chantal tells us more.
I'm Chantal Villefort in French, and I'm the Director of Marketing, Communications, and Sales at Festival du Voyageur.
Most people will know at this point, but What exactly is Festival du Voyageur?
So Festival du Voyageur is just a staple in the Manitoba community here. It is actually the largest French event in Western Canada. It also doubles as the largest winter festival in Western Canada, which is really great. It's a winter festival that consists of a lot of traditional elements to it. It began about 50, this will be our 53rd edition of Festival this year in 2022, and consists of, you know, traditional music, French-Canadian meals, and traditional cultures and horse sleigh rides and dog rides, and our very famous snow sculptures as well. We have a snow sculpture symposium, usually an international one, so that's always a great thing. And we have a historical interpretation at the Fort Gibraltar as well. So it's really the park around Whittier Park around Fort Gibraltar that gets transformed into the Voyageur Park every year for this event.
Yeah, you mentioned 53 years. How many years has it been affected by COVID now? It feels like such a long time. Like, time just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, you're right. And actually, that's kind of funny, Ryan, because we always say, oh, you know, the last festival in 2020, and people correct us and they say, I think you mean 2019. And we say, no, we actually had a festival 3 weeks before the lockdown in 2020. So we were kind of that last big gathering here in Manitoba and that last big celebration of, you know, people coming together in an environment where you could be together in a tent and celebrate and dance. And so last year was really the first year that it got affected in 2021, and the restrictions were very, very strict at that time. So we pivoted to a virtual edition of festival. So we tried as much as possible to offer the feel and all of the traditional things that people love about Festival from home. So virtual concerts that were recorded. We did things like take home meals of the traditional meals of the Tourtière and Tatoursuk and Sopopois competition, as well as the typical jig and violon contest, which everybody loves. We did a virtual edition, and as well as the beard growing. I see you have a beard there. So the beard growing contest as well was virtual and was more of just a fun thing last year.
I know another cool component is the logos always changing. And I saw like the new revealed logo for 2022. Really cool stuff. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so this is our third year working with local artist Jordan Stranger here, and he's an amazing artist, and we just love him. He works so well with Festival, and he did his first design for Festival in 2020, and it was so beautifully well received. Used so many different meanings and colors around it, and just did such a great job that we worked with him last year as well. And last year, the logo was a bit more open logo, kind of showing the outdoorsy, more warmer kind of colors. And this year, you know, we're kind of taking a chance. This was when we were designing this with Jordan, was more around August, September, when things are looking a little better. So we're very optimistic and kind of designed the logo with it being, you know, more of a coming together and people coming together and listening to music together and just joining again under the tents and things like that. So, you know, situation has changed, but that doesn't mean that feeling is not there. So that's still the feeling that we want people to have and to be positive and optimistic about is, you know, finding your friends again and finding your family members and people you haven't seen maybe in 2 years pre-COVID, that people find themselves again at Voyageur Park, being able to enjoy the activities and programming that we put on.
When we're talking about, you know, the history of French Canadians here in Manitoba, but I mean, you can't not talk about the Métis people, you know, directly involved in Manitoba's creation. So, you know, what can you share about how Métis and First Nations culture is intertwined within French Canadian culture that we celebrate at Festival?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's you can't have one without the other. It's just, it's part of its history. It's part of the fort's history and the Northwest Company and all of that. So, you know, I am almost a product or exhibit of that generational, evolution and all these things. So, yeah, I mean, I know that within our festival, we've really done a lot of work to represent all of those different cultures coming together and seeing different ways we can represent that in our programming. And I know, like, for myself personally, so I'm Métis, I'm French Métis, and you know, I didn't kind of start learning about what that meant to be Francophone Métis and French Métis in Manitoba. I was a little bit older and even into kind of my adult years. So my brother, actually, Miguel, he's the owner of Itchy Boy, who does all of the sashes and things like that for festivals. So once he started his company and really educating himself on our culture and our history, that really brought about my own learning and my own understanding of what it meant to be French Métis and how intertwined it really is in the community and everything that we do. And especially with Festival, is such a great representation of all those cultures coming together. And we do such a, you know, we keep learning, we keep building and fostering relationships with different elders and things like that. And if I can permit myself to elaborate, so Festival itself takes on more of a, as well as a private approach with the staff as well, just with educating us and having private ceremonies with elders, just so we can better understand where we're coming from when we're putting these things in our programming. And it's really coming from a place of understanding rather than just, you know, doing it because we feel like it's the right thing to do. We do it because we truly believe in that reconciliation, those relationships and fostering that.
Multiculturalism is such an important part of like just modern Canada. You can't have that without Indigenous and First Nation communities. So I'm really excited when I see initiatives that want to bring those cultures and voices of people to the forefront.
Some of the things that we try and incorporate in our programming, I mean, we obviously have the musical artists and the performances around that. So we have just a variety. We're always thinking of that when we're, you know, making sure to book certain acts and things like that. You know, we've got some new stuff coming in this year, which is really exciting. We've got the Infinity Fire, which I've alluded to in some of the communication that we put out last week. That's something that's, you know, was kind of thought out internally here. And it's something that we're building with some partners and some of our elders in at Turtle Lodge and with the Union Métis Saint-Joseph. So we, we're going to be introducing that. It's going to be really cool. It's a new fixture that's going to be part of the park. And we hope that it's just going to be there for a very long time. And the representation behind it will be really, really fun for everyone to see.
What other components or facets of festival? I mean, you've elaborated a little bit on some of them, but what can people all expect this year?
This year, we kind of have what we call four pillars to the festival. So just to simplify a bit the messaging, we've got the Voyageur Park, which will be transformed a little different this year. We won't have the big tents like we typically do because of the restrictions. We will have a warm-up tent though, and we will have, you know, a spot where people can buy souvenirs and things like that. We'll have food truck vendors where people can get some food. We'll have some traditional food as well. We'll have the interpretation outdoor on the in the fort. We'll also have the kids playground, the snow playground, which is always very popular. The horse sleigh rides, have some ice sculpting workshops. So there's going to be a lot that people are going to be able to do once they get into the park. The nice big thing in the park this year is that new La Boîte à Chansons, which we call it. It's our new mobile concert trailer. I've actually had the pleasure of going to see the construction of it this week and they're putting it together. It looks awesome. I'm very excited about it. It's really great to present to the student community and we'll be able to use it during the summer and things like that with partners. So it's a really great piece that we're adding to Festival this year. So that's the first. So there's Voyageur Park. And then we also have concerts in the evenings at CCFM, so Centre culturel franco-manitobain, that's on Provence. We're going to have evening concerts there, as well as the jig and fiddle competitions there as well in person with a virtual category. So that would be the second pillar. And this year, if everything goes well, with the trailer, we're actually going to transport the trailer from the park to the Forks. And we're going to have some free concerts there for everybody to enjoy. So those will be during the evening week of Festival. So they'll be programming each day of the week this year. So the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday evenings, and possibly Friday as well at the Forks, close to the, I don't know exactly the spot, but it'll be there.
When people go to the Forks, they'll be able to see.
They'll hear it. It's a big thing and there'll be music coming out of it. They won't be able to miss it. So yeah, those will be really great. Probably from 6 to 8 type thing of programming. And then we'll have the virtual component as well. So we're going to release some new pre-recorded concerts throughout the week, as well as people will be able to do the take home meal kits again with the cocktails, which are being created right now too, which is great. So they'll be able to do and participate that way as well.
I've also seen some like video components posted on the social media. Is that just to like hype things up, to give previews of things, or is that like an independent project within all of Festival?
Re-release, so we do have some content from last year that's still up on our YouTube channel that people can enjoy. So past concerts and things like our Midshift, Minute Midshift series. So we are developing a second series of Minute Midshift. They were well received. So we're going to be, we've already filmed them and they're almost ready to go to release them during the week of Festival. We've also got some different videos where people can do activities at home, like build their own snow sculptures in their backyards, things like that, make their own, you know, taffy. So those are all online and we're just kind of getting people excited. We can't sell tickets yet, so we're trying to get people hyped up. It's festival season and we want to get people excited about it. So we will be re-releasing some more content for 2022, but that 2021 stuff is still there up for everybody to enjoy.
The snow sculptures, always exciting when you're going down, you see them, you know, down the boulevard, like it's so exciting. So you said international, so there's people coming from all over the world to, you know, partake in this competition?
Typically, yes. So typically it's an international competition. So this year, obviously we weren't able to move forward with an international competition. What we did was a Canadian one. So we've got some teams coming in. We've got a few teams coming in from some provinces and territories, and then we've got some local teams as well here. So that consists of seven big different sculptures that are in the park that are part of the symposium. So seven different teams working on those. But yes, you will have seen some of the big blocks all over the city. I think the one in front of the museum is started, almost done even. We've got some of the big blocks put on Provence and they'll be starting to work on those sooner than later. So yeah, when you get those and the billboards going up, you kind of get that festival feel and it's great.
This will be the second year that Festival has had to deal with COVID restrictions. What are some of the challenges when, you know, planning an outdoor event like this?
What challenges? I don't know. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that by now everybody kind of knows the type of things that you have to adapt to and change and modify according to restrictions and things like that. I think, you know, had you asked me that question, you know, in December, end of November, we were more positive that we would be able to return to a full festival in person with the tents and everything. Some of the challenges, you know, really have to do with adapting super quick, not losing, you know, optimism that we can offer something, and really reminding ourselves that we're doing it because we love festival and the community loves festival and it brings joy and it brings, you know, smiles to faces. So we want to make sure that we continue having that festival joie de vivre that everybody always talks about and loves. So, you know, with the virtual last year, didn't want to give up, wanted to make sure we could offer something. People were at home, they needed something to look forward to and make them smile and to support artists as well. So that's been something we've had to adapt to this year with the new restrictions after Christmas, that a lot of the first thing we had to do was cancel our contracts with artists out of province, unfortunately. But it also gives us a great opportunity to really focus on supporting our local artists. So, you know, to not give up on giving them their contracts and trying as hard as we can to offer as many contracts as we could, depending on the platforms that we had to offer them for the concerts. So, yeah, some of their challenges, and then some with volunteers and things like that. So, you know, it's a little more challenging to find, you know, some people to help with building the park and volunteers for the park itself. We are still looking for volunteers if anybody's interested. And yeah, and just adapting our programming. You know, we didn't want to go full virtual this year if we were able to offer in-person events and in-person activities. So we wanted to make sure to try and do that as much as possible and offer a hybrid rather than just go virtual or just canceling. We really want to, we're not giving up. We don't want to give up. And we hope that we can really bring something fun for everyone to be able to participate in.
Yeah, it's exciting when you can have like people from across Canada coming here to celebrate. But that's right, there are so many amazing and talented people here in Manitoba.
So many, and even in the French community as well. Just we know so many of them, and you know, to support them and to give them that platform that Festival offers them is just fun, and we're very proud to be able to do that.
When does Festival officially kickoff this year. And you mentioned something about tickets. When do those go live?
Yeah. So festival is officially February 18th to the 27th. So the Friday to the next Sunday. And it will vary on the activities. Like I said, some will be the concerts at the CCFM. Sometimes you'll be able to come into the park. All of our information is on our website right now. We released some information last week. We'll continue to update that as things change. So people can always refer to that. For ticket sales specifically, we're just waiting for those new restrictions to come in to see what we can offer in terms of how many people to have in the park safely and make sure that we do that safely and with and just aligning with all of the public health restrictions as well. So that's kind of where we're at. But as soon as they are on sale, people will know about it. They can follow us. We have Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and we have our website heho.ca that people can refer to as well.
Mm-hmm. It's just a few weeks away. So what are you most excited about for this year's festival?
I'm excited to see people at the park. Honestly, this is, and to hear the music, and really, I hope that people get wowed with the new concert trailer, La Boîte à Chansons. I think, like I said, I've seen it a little bit and I'm just excited and I haven't even seen the final product. So to see everybody at the park and just enjoying themselves and seeing, you know, the families come out and the music and the food and just that atmosphere, like I was saying, that joie de vivre, that atmosphere that festival gives to people, to have that feeling again, it's kind of a very heartwarming feeling and it makes everybody very happy. So I can't wait to get that feeling. It'll be great.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned volunteers. Where can people find out more information if they want to volunteer?
Yeah, so if you just go on our website, like I said, heho.ca, we've got the button there, that right at the top, red button, you can't miss it, that says, you know, become a volunteer. Click on there and it'll bring you to the volunteer page that has all the information and all of the different positions that we're still looking for.
J'espère nous revoir. Qu'est-ce qu'il faut que je fasse, que je puisse rester encore? Oh, oh, je suis moins du rock'n'roll. J'ai le diable dans le corps, il faut que je le sors. Oh, y a-t-il quelqu'un qui va répondre? Ça peut pas être en vain que je hurle dans le noir. Je commence à zéro. Qu'une miette d'espoir fait chanter les oiseaux. J'aspire les airs, j'assemble mon radeau. Tant que le jour se lève, je te chanterai mon eau. Les flammes sexy, les parfums sont la messe, la mélodie s'anime. Oh, embrasse-moi tout bas, le départ se rattrape, faisons le fuir encore. Oh, embrasse-moi plus fort, je veux qu'on se perde dans l'écume du brouillard. Oh, 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 mets ta ligne à l'eau, c'est pas qu'on en parle. Thank you.
steps the Cossacks, riding with his fellow Cossacks at his side, and you can feel the Cossacks full of pride and passion's grace. On the way to glory, trusting in their faith to lead them on to victory and grace of God, believing freedom is a right that all men have to see. And fighting for what you believe it has to be. For freedom is a right men have to see. So won't you fly, Cossack, try, Cossack, against the sticks and tatters go, Cossack, show, Cossack, that is where your heart is be, Cossack, free, Cossack, lead us all to victory. God be with you, live, Cossack, love, Cossack, such a spirit must be free, Cossack, be, Cossack, freedom is for you and me. We are brothers for eternity. Try, Cossack, against those Turks and Tatars go, Cossack, show, Cossack, that is where your heart is be, Cossack, free, Cossack, lead us all to victory. God be with you, live, Cossack, love, Cossack, such a spirit must be free, Cossack, be, Cossack, freedom is for you and me. We are brothers for eternity. Now the Cossacks, just the story, but his legend lives on, of the glory, what he lived and he died for, so no more he'd be a slave to another man. And if the Cossack has to die, then let him find his glory neath the sky, so you can hear of how and why he had to die that way. There was nothing as too high a price to pay. He still lives on in the hearts of men today. So won't you fly, Cossack, try, Cossack, against those Turks and Tatars go, Cossack, show, Cossack, that is where your heart is be, Cossack, free, Cossack, lead us all to victory. God be with you, live, Cossack, love, Cossack, such a spirit must be free, Cossack, be, Cossack, freedom is for you and me. We are brothers for eternity. We are brothers for eternity. Cossack, hey!
When you drive outside of Winnipeg, you fast realize how much of southern Manitoba is farmland. But who started these farms so many years ago? One group was the Mennonites. Let's take a deep dive into these early farmers. And we have Conrad from the Mennonite Archives to share their history with us.
My name is Conrad Stace, and I'm the archivist at the Mennonite Heritage Archives on the campus of Canadian Mennonite University in Winnipeg.
So I guess the important question is, you know, what are the Mennonite archives? What were they? When were they established? And as an archivist, what do you do there?
Well, these particular archives were established here in Winnipeg in 1933. They were created out of a sense of loss, actually. There was a Mennonite archive in Russia, in the mid-1920s, it was confiscated by the secret police. And this archive was an attempt to start over. So today, our archive responds to over 100 requests for information a month. If you stack all our paper on top of each other, it's higher than the CN Tower. So it's over half a kilometer high, 600 meters of materials that we have. And we have all sorts of people that come to our archive to use this material. We have scholars, genealogists, family historians, lawyers, documentary filmmakers, journalists, a whole slew of people coming using the archive to answer important questions.
One of those things, you never know you need it until you're doing a project like that. I was talking to an individual from like the Muslim Association of Manitoba, and he's creating a book about the early Muslims here in Manitoba. And there's no archives like that. So it was really difficult for him to find that sort of information that he needed.
Yeah, often archives kind of spring up out of this anniversary events, or people want to tell a story and they realize, well, where are these documents? Where are these stories? And so then they spend time collecting the materials. They write their project, write their book. And then, well, what are we going to do with this material? Well, we should start an archive, is often how things like this start.
And I think it's just so interesting, like the history of Mennonites, and we'll go into a little bit more detail, but just exploring some of these museums out in like the prairie communities, like the Miami Museum and other things like that. It is just so interesting seeing like life of what these early immigrants and farmers was like. So the important question, who were the early Mennonites that first came here to Manitoba?
Right. So we got to, you know, back up the bus a little bit. Mennonites grew out of the Protestant Reformation in Western Europe in the 1500s. There was a man by the name of Menno Simons who became a leader in this Protestant group. And his followers were called Mennonites after Menno Simons. Many were from Dutch, German, Swiss background. They were a Christian group who believed in nonviolence. They believed that baptism and becoming a member of a church happened as an adult. It didn't happen earlier. And the importance of community in church-making decisions, that all voices had a right to be heard. And for some of these beliefs, they weren't always welcome in different parts of Europe, so they moved around a lot. And the first Mennonites went to Russia in 1789. And then about 100 years later, in the 1870s, laws were changing in Russia and now in what is Ukraine. The Russian government wanted more control over schools, and they wanted to revoke the exemption from military service that was promised to the Mennonites. So some Mennonites started looking for, okay, so what are our options? And a delegation was sent out to North America in 1873, and they checked out Manitoba. And the Canadian government wanted more people in the province. They wanted farmers. Treaty 1 had been signed. And so the government produced a document, this document here, in 1873, that highlighted and laid out, if you guys come to Manitoba, this is what you get. This is our promises. This is kind of our contract with you. And in there was land and help settlement. But for the Mennonites, what was really important was exemption from military service, and they could control their own schools. Those are very important things. So about a third of the Mennonites left Russia in the 1870s. 10,000 went to the United States, but 7,000 came to Manitoba because of this letter, because of the exemption from military service, and because of they could run their own schools. And so two parcels of land was set aside for their settlement, their exclusive settlement. So one on the east side of the Red River in the Steinbach area, it was called the East Reserve, a little creative name. And the other settlement was in the Altona Winkler area, the West Reserve, west side of the river. And the first few years were very difficult. But after the first few years, you know, early they had to deal with early frost and too wet conditions. And so farming was really difficult getting going. After that, you know, they started to really flourish and expand, and they grew out of those reserves and moved around the province, and you start moving to Saskatchewan and Alberta. Then during World War I, Canada was at war with Germany, and the Canadian government honored their promise of exemption from military service. But the public, the Canadian public, was not very happy with the way the Mennonites were not supporting the war effort the way that they thought they should. And as a way of making more Mennonites more patriotic, the governments in Saskatchewan and Manitoba introduced compulsory attendance for schools. So Mennonites had to send, well, not just Mennonites, anybody in the province had to send their children to government-run schools. So the ability to run their own schools was taken away. And the government wanted more obedient citizens and they thought education was the way to do this. Some Mennonites thought, okay, we can work with this. We'll find other ways of creating and instilling values in our community. Some resisted. And so those who resisted and didn't send their kids to school, they were jailed, they were fined, they even had farm machinery, animals, even food confiscated. So in Saskatchewan alone, there were over 4,500 prosecutions of these families that wouldn't send their kids to public school because they said, government, you promised us that we could run our own schools. Well, this went on. And so finally, this group that was resisting said, this isn't working for us. Canada's not a good place for us. And so 7,000 moved to Mexico and Paraguay, starting in 1922, 100 years ago this year. And so that's how those communities in Latin America first got started.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. It's like, yeah, they come over to Manitoba, like Canada, the United States. And then you had the group that went even further south. And then you have some that are moving back now. I know I have a couple friends who have a like.
Yeah, that's right. And then so these people are moving out and starting in 1922. But the Russian Revolution has happened in Russia, and that's created a lot of upheaval. So between 1923 and 1930, you have a second wave of migration of Mennonites into Manitoba from Russia. So 20,000 come to Canada between 23 and 1930. Another group, another wave post-World War II come. And then, like you were saying, people in the 1990s started coming back from Mexico and Paraguay to Manitoba. And then another complicating or factor is that you start having people coming out of Europe in the 1990s to Canada. So yeah, there's a lot of moving around and happening.
Yeah, I think the most interesting, like based on the history of some Mennonites had to be like assimilated within the government-run school systems, you see like, especially like out in Winkler, Altona, the Pembina Valley region, you can definitely see the cultural differences between people who were, you know, put through the government schools and then people coming over now. There's a very difference between at least those European Mennonites.
Today in southern Manitoba or around the province, you know, there's a large variety. There are over 42 denominations in Canada, about 150,000 adult members in Canada, not counting kids. And some Mennonites, you can tell that they're Mennonites by the way they dress, and others you can't. There's, you know, in Manitoba, Kelvin Gertsen was our first Mennonite premier, and we have Mennonites sitting in Headingley Penitentiary. We have, and they're around the province, they're in doctors, lawyers, truck drivers, carpenters, bakers, a variety of people today.
When you're talking about like the different denominations of Mennonite, like I know a joke often told out in the Pembina Valley is, you know, when you disagree with someone, you just start a new church.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. You put four Mennonites in a room and you get five opinions.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's definitely a very diverse group, and it's like changed a lot over the years, specifically through missions trips. You know, we see Mennonites all over the world now.
Yeah, that's right. So there are, what I've talked about is people who have a European background. There have always been people coming into the Mennonite community and leaving and joining the Mennonite community for appreciating their values and how they run church. And so, yeah, there's a large Mennonite population around the world today, in part because of mission work, but also just people being in the community and wanting to join in the church.
I know there can often be a little confusion around, you know, Mennonites is like, oh, is this a culture thing? Is this a religious thing? Because sometimes the cultural aspects of like the European Mennonites kind of gets name as a whole.
Yeah, it's difficult to give a short answer to that question. And people, you know, really debate that. And in my mind, there's, you know, kind of three categories. You know, there's the faith category, there's the culture category, and another category that is both. So there are people who self-identify as Mennonite because of the church they attend or the values they hold. This can include people who are relatively new to the church or people who have long-standing roots in the church. Then there are people who value the culture but don't have any church affiliation anymore. But they enjoy maybe some of the food and folkways. Maybe they even speak this Mennonite Low German language. And then there's people kind of who have a foot in both camps, who are both. They attend a Mennonite church and they have a longstanding appreciation of the Mennonite culture in the Mennonite community. And so, yeah, there's it's both culture and faith. And it's to people trying to figure it out at the beginning, it can be kind of confusing.
In some aspects, it's very similar to Judaism, where it can be both cultural, like it's a people's and it's a faith. Like in the United States, you have a lot of people who are culturally Jewish but aren't practicing. But I guess it's kind of in that aspect where, you know, there was an established culture in the beginning when it was just forming, kind of taking those European influences. But since then, it's evolved.
And it has evolved and it will keep evolving.
Yeah, it'll keep changing.
In Manitoba, it keeps changing every time there's a new migration group that comes in, or there's a new people joining from within the province already.
What can we learn about the history of Mennonites? Because it's something you don't often hear about in school. Like even out in the Pembina Valley, they don't, unless you're taking a Mennonite studies class, they don't really talk about, you know, mass migrations of people who help establish the farming communities around there.
Yeah, I think it would be great to have a class or even a whole course on Mennonite migration in our school system. That would be really good. So what can we learn? I think one of the things is the power of community. The early years, it was the communities that were fundamental to establishing lasting settlements on the open prairie. They had to rely on each other. These communities have established organizations to help people around the world. You have Mennonite Central Committee, Mennonite Disaster Service. They go around the world where there's a disaster, a hurricane or a tornado or earthquake or a flood, and they go and help people rebuild. Mennonite Economic Development Associates is another one, Canadian Food Grains Bank. And for a small community like the Mennonite community, they've really done a lot in helping others. And another thing about community is you need a community to maintain a culture. That's really important. Another thing we can learn is that not just from the Mennonite community, but since we're talking about Mennonites, Canada did not always have and did not always value multiculturalism. For some time, it was difficult to be different. And the process or the underlying assumption was to fit into a certain kind of mold in what you believed and how you talked and these types of things. And so some of the Mennonites resisted this. And because they were part of a community, they could resist. You know, on your own, it's a lot much more difficult. So that's another thing to learn from the Mennonite experience. And Mennonites have really valued peace and nonviolence. That's been a big value for them. And that's something that they've brought also to the Canadian context.
The multicultural aspect. Yeah, before it's like you had English-speaking Canada like and French-speaking Canada. If you didn't fall into either of those categories, yeah, you were an outsider. And I love seeing how it's developed multiculturalism because it's so fun to go around and learn about other people's cultures and just the food aspect. And I think that's definitely something Mennonites can bring to the table in terms of multiculturalism, those foods. I know they're not for everyone, but man, like a good Zuma borscht.
Yeah, I love Zuma borscht. Yeah, and so everywhere the Mennonites have gone, they've kind of picked up food and folkways from where they're living and they've kind of adapted it. And so, for example, one of the earliest ones is the Mennonite New Year's cookies called Parseltje.
Okay. Parseltje, I don't think I've had that, but Rakuk and I I know that.
Parseltje is like a fried raisin fritter. And they picked it up when Mennonites were living in the lowlands in the Netherlands. So the Dutch people, they create what they call oliebollen, which is a fried raisin fritter that they create for New Year's Day. And so the Mennonites have carried on that tradition to this day. And so, you know, New Year's Eve, I was making parseltje in my home And there were Mennonites in Latin America, and there were Dutch people in Holland making the same thing. And so they picked up these foodways and kind of adopted them. Zomerborscht, Kamsborscht, Veranikje, all these things. I love them.
Like Mennonite foods can really be just a staple of kind of like world food put into one group a little bit.
Yeah.
You got pierogies like from Ukraine.
Right. And so Mennonite dough pockets, we call them Veranikje, have cottage cheese in them. And the Ukrainian pierogies often will have potato and cheese, potato and bacon, those types of staples. Whereas I grew up having just the cottage cheese. And later on, some people started putting fruit in them.
Yeah. The blueberries, like kind of dessert pierogies. Yeah, so good. Yeah, cottage cheese pierogies. They're like my favorite. With some schmofat put over top of it.
Mm. Yeah, cream gravy.
What is it? There's like, I can't remember the name of it, but for like waffles or pancakes, white sauce. That's good too.
Yeah, it's an
I'm a bad Mennonite. I don't remember most of the names.
Yeah, I've asked people what do they call that white sauce, and people just say either white sauce or this one family that called it schmagus, and I don't know if that's right or not, but it's instead of having syrup, it was a way of making a sweet syrup out of the waffle dough,
yeah,
with added sugar and stuff, and then you would pour it onto the waffles.
Yeah, I remember going to a friend's house. And he's like, oh, here, try this. And I'm like, what is this? I've never seen it before. I guess it's just so interesting. Yeah, the different involvement in Mennonite culture that different individuals have. Like my upbringing wasn't too much. There's some, but maybe I'd like to see a little bit more. Maybe I'll try exploring, you know, my Mennonite heritage a little bit come once everything is settled down a little bit. But what is your favorite Mennonite meal or maybe just Mennonite food, yeah.
Wow. I have so many. One of my favorite comfort foods would be Kamsborscht, which is a cabbage borscht. So in Ukrainians, the way I understand it, would make a beet borscht, but this is made with cabbage and tomatoes. I really enjoy that. But my all-time favorite is the cottage cheese Veranikje, cottage cheese pierogies, with some ham and some cream gravy. That's my ultimate favorite.
That's a classic meal for like your grandma to make for everyone to come over for supper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when we go to my parents' place, then my kids always want to have Veranikje, grandma and grandpa's.
Since you work in an archive, what sort of document or information that you've come across that has just kind of like blown your mind that you've just gotten really, really excited for?
Boy, I mean this one I showed you here. This, I think, is our most important document, this letter of invitation from the Canadian government. But there's all sorts of interesting things that come across, that I come across in the archives. Some of our oldest stuff is from the 1500s. Our biggest item is a book. It's actually a Spanish Catholic music book.
Oh,
that's got to be, let's see here, 3 feet wide and 4 feet tall, weighs about 50 pounds. The covers are made of wood. The binding is made with metal hinges. Mm-hmm. And it was used as a instead of off the wall singing where you project music on the wall, this you'd stand in a semicircle around this music book and sing out of it. So it's not Mennonite at all, but we have it here as a way of, it's a teaching tool that people who talk about music history come in and use it, but also people who talk about history of bookmaking or history of calligraphy and artistic design come and view this book. So I bring this book out a couple times every year. So that's a really cool thing. We have a book from 1551 that was used by a Mennonite midwife. That is a book of herbs. So not only does it list the plants, but also the medicinal values of this plant.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, so that's definitely
something that can apply to modern life.
Yeah. And so some of the midwifery recipes that we've done some work with is really interesting stuff. I've done a fair amount of research on conscientious objectors, those in World War II who served Canada, but not with arms. They were working in forestry or in mining or in farming to support the government and the war effort. So that's a story I find interesting and not well known. There are over 10,000 people who served Canada without weapons in World War II. And those people came from 24 different communities, not Mennonite communities, different religious communities across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another interesting story that we have, that I research.
Well, sounds like there's some really cool items over there.
Yeah, there are. If you like stories, this is the place to be.
Can the general public visit the archive?
Yeah, absolutely. Now with COVID, we ask for people to make an appointment. So we kind of regulate who's coming in when. But yeah, the public is welcome to come on in. And the green screen I have behind me is part of my reading room. So this is what you see there is some of the periodicals that we have. And then there's that door you just see kind of off in the corner.
Yeah.
Oh. Over there.
That one, right there. Yeah.
Yeah. So behind that, we call that our vault. And behind there is, 1,600 square feet of vault space where we have these documents in boxes.
That's
documents and books and, yep, all sorts of stuff.
Maybe I'm going to have to plan a friend hangout to go visit the archive sometime because it sounds just like a really, really cool place.
Yeah, it is. I really enjoy it. I learn something old every day in my job. Yeah, and it's always interesting to see what kind of questions people come to the archives with and want to answer. And it's fun being part of that research process. And when people come and say, I want to know something about, this topic, then I got to think for a while. Okay, so how do I find that? Because archives are not arranged like a book.
Mm-hmm.
To do archival research is different than doing book research or internet research. And because we don't have time to index everything. And so we have to create different ways of finding that information. We create contextual knowledge about the records. And so sometimes it takes a while to figure, okay, how do you get at that question? And sometimes people are surprised that, you don't have anything on that, or you can't just pull that off the shelf. Like if someone wanted to find out, I'm going to do some research on tractors. I don't have a box on tractors.
Tractors.
Right?
Yeah, you got to go in. It develops your problem solving and investigative skills.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yep. Very true.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Conrad. It was great speaking with you. And hopefully we can inspire some people to come and check out the archives.
Yeah, absolutely. Come on in. We're open Monday to Friday, 8:30 to 4:30. Check out our website. We're on Instagram and Facebook as well.
Want to hear more stories? Tune in to 101.5 FM every Tuesday at 1 for U-Talk. I'm Ryan Funk. This was U-Talk. And have yourself a good one.
Jamais, tu resterais une de mes rêves. À jamais. jouer la prude.